Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's an ongoing reality in Missouri that African Americans are more likely than whites to be stopped by police, a lot more likely. A new report from the Missouri Attorney General's office shows blacks are about 70% more likely to be stopped. That's down a bit, but down from 2014's record high for this kind of data that started being collected in 2000. What does it mean? And are the numbers a true reflection of what's going on? And there are other numbers out there, and that relates to the national homicide rate. It seems to be spiking. We're talking about it all with Rick Rosenfeld, the Thomas Jefferson Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He helped compile the data on profiling. You might have heard him this morning talking about an increase in nationwide homicide numbers. He was on Morning Edition. You're all over the place today, Rick. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Congratulations for you. You recently received a very prestigious honor for excellence in the work you do, so we're all the more happy to have you here with us today.
Happy to be back.
We're going to started to talk about profiling as our subject matter today, but these numbers for which you were on Morning Edition today really jumped to the fore. Mm-hmm. There's been this spike in homicide. What does it mean?
Well, I was asked by the Department of Justice to prepare a paper outlining research directions for understanding the homicide spike that we saw last year and that has persisted in some places into the current year. So I looked at 56 of the largest cities in the United States. I found there was a 17% rise in homicide in those cities in 1 year, and that's not quite unprecedented, but almost. So the rise was very abrupt, quite precipitous, and large. In 10 of those 56 cities, their homicides accounted for two-thirds of the total increase, and in those cities, homicides went up 33%. So the phenomenon is real. There's a debate out there about what caused it. I examined three explanations in my paper. I drew no firm conclusions. I was asked to outline research directions, and that's what I did. One explanation is that imprisonment rates in the United States have been declining modestly over the last few years. As more ex-prisoners return home, they have a higher than average chance of being the next victim or committing the next crime. And so maybe it's returning prisoners that's driven up homicide rates. The problem with that argument, though I think it's plausible, is that returning prisoners has been a phenomenon over the last several years. It's not clear to me why that would all of a sudden register a large increase in 2015. The same is true with another plausible explanation. The nation's in the midst of a major and very serious opioid epidemic. Heroin epidemic is part of that. As drug markets expand, more disputes between buyers and sellers or among sellers occur. They're often accompanied by violence. We might expect homicide rates to go up. But like the imprisonment explanation, this one doesn't quite get the timing of the homicide increase right. That explanation, or I should say that drug epidemic has been in process for several years now. Again, not clear why that would all of a sudden register increases in 2015. That brings us to the explanation that has dominated the news, the so-called Ferguson effect. Two versions of that. One is that because of criticism associated with controversial police use of force incidents involving African-American suspects, the police have withdrawn from full engagement in their duties, and we've seen crime rates increase as a result. But there's another version, and that's the version I lay out on the paper that also is worthy of further scrutiny, which is that it's based on longstanding grievances for which there's plenty of evidence in the disadvantaged areas of minority communities throughout the United States, grievances with the police. The police aren't there to protect us when they need them. They harass us when we don't, boiling that discontent down to its essentials. It's possible that under conditions like those we've experienced over the last year and a half, that latent discontent, let's call it, because it certainly predates Ferguson, gets activated. And if people really do lose faith in the police to protect them, they may take matters into their own hands, and we can see violence result as a result of that. So I lay out several explanations. I point to evidence that I think could be used to evaluate them. And I'm hopeful that the public debate continues. Debate is good, but that now perhaps it's on sounder footing.
Let's just step back for one second. Where does the St. Louis and our region stack up amongst these 56 cities that you looked at?
Well, it's certainly one of the 56 largest cities. Among the 10 cities that account for two-thirds of that increase in the 56-city sample, St. Louis is one of the 10. It's actually down at the bottom of the list of the 10, though. St. Louis experienced an 18% increase in homicide in 2015. Now, I should say that was on top of a 32% increase the year before. Mm-hmm. So St. Louis was one of the 10 cities that made it into what I refer to in the paper as the top 10, but certainly not at the top or even near it. City of Cleveland had a 90% increase in homicide in 1 year. Orlando, Florida, which is in the news for so many other reasons these days, had a 100% increase in their homicide rate in 1 year. And we're talking about homicides. We're not talking about percentage increases from 2 to 4 homicides. We're talking about homicide levels that are already pretty high.
Well, you've changed your thinking somewhat with regard to the Ferguson effect. Mm-hmm. We've talked before about this. You did not think there was a Ferguson effect.
I looked at data for St. Louis some time ago, and this is for the year 2014. And on a month-by-month comparison of homicides and other crimes in the city from 2013, the year before, to 2014, I saw that homicide rates had begun to go up in the city of St. Louis prior to the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson of August of 2014. And so I said for the crime of homicide, it didn't appear to me that a something like a Ferguson effect could be all that's driving the rates up, because it appeared to be going up prior to August of 14. Then I looked at 56 cities, and the patterns I saw in those cities were really quite consistent, at least on the face of it, with something that triggered a homicide increase very suddenly. And an increase, as I've mentioned, in some cities that was very, very large. Something like the events surrounding controversial police use of force incidents seems to me has to be part of the discussion now. And so my thinking, let's say, has developed.
Wouldn't you think, though, if there is this Ferguson effect, that it would be more pronounced in this area than it might be in other places?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for our chief, Chief Dotson, but he is, after all, the person who coined the phrase, the Ferguson effect, in an interview he did not long after the Michael Brown killing. During 2014 in St. Louis, immediately after the Michael Brown incident, we did see homicides increase. Now, as I've said, they were going up beforehand, too. That doesn't discount, though, the possible contribution of a so-called Ferguson effect in St. Louis. If it happened in St. Louis, it may have happened a little earlier, which is why we saw that big bump in 14 and a somewhat smaller bump in 15.
Let's just be absolutely clear on what the Ferguson effect
sure.
is. You've alluded to it in a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
What is the Ferguson effect?
It has two versions. The basic argument is that the events surrounding controversial police use of force incidents that we're all aware of over the last year are now going on almost 2 years. Cause the police to withdraw from full engagement in their duties. They're not as likely to get out of the patrol car to make an investigation and so forth. And as a result, crimes go up. That's one version. Another version, the one that I suggest in this paper also needs scrutiny, is that longstanding discontent in communities of color with the police get activated under current conditions. Where police use of force has become controversial and may lead members of those or other communities to think that the police are ineffective in helping them. And under those conditions, people are more likely to take matters into their own hands, to carry firearms, use them perhaps in ways they might not have otherwise. And that, too, could trigger a crime increase.
So the Brown shooting kind of takes the lid off. And
right. And it's called Ferguson effect only because that was one of the very first incidents. It made it into the press because of Chief Dotson's comment. But obviously, I hope you're listeners understand, it's not simply Ferguson. It's the collection of incidents that made the news over the last year or so.
You hope for a public dialogue leading to what? I mean, how do we resolve these issues?
Well, I hope for the public dialogue to do two things. First of all, we could have more information. We should have more information to evaluate these various explanations of the crime rise in 2015. Indeed, we'd have better information on more than just 56 cities about the crime rise itself if the Federal Bureau of Investigation would enter the 21st century and begin providing crime data to the public much sooner than it does. We won't get year-end 2015 crime data until this coming fall. We could have been getting it much sooner than that on a month-by-month basis. During the 1930s, the FBI did produce monthly crime reports. I'm only asking they go back there. I want the public dialogue to continue, and I want it to be based on sounder evidence. And quite obviously, as a researcher, I want researchers to pay strong attention to this issue.
That's an incredible lag time, and you can't react to something until you have that information.
It's baffling.
Yeah. I want to take a couple of calls on this subject before we get to the racial profiling issue. We'll do that, but I'll take my break now and then come back and take a couple of calls who folks want to address this issue. We're talking with Rick Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, about crime statistics, both in terms of homicides and racial profiling. And we'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Rick Rosenfeld. Our conversation has started with the discussion about the spate in homicides across the country over the last several months, and he attributes that to what is being called the Ferguson effect. Let's take a couple of calls, Rick. We'll start with Cheryl calling from St. Louis, who has an idea about what one part of the problem might be. Cheryl, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Professor, I'm wondering if you've looked at the loosening of gun laws. I'm thinking about, in particular, the concealed carry, open carry, and whether or not you see that as having any sort of impact on the spike in the homicide rate.
I have taken a look, and it's entirely possible that in those places where gun laws have been changed in the very recent past, because recall, we're talking about a spike in homicide that followed a fairly long-term decline. It is possible that that has contributed to an increase in homicide, but that wouldn't be very many places over the last year or so. But it's certainly, if you don't mind the expression, a worthy contender for explanations of why crime rates increased, homicide in particular, over the last year or so.
Cheryl, thank you for the call. Of course, Missouri has a new law. And that's just going to give everybody the opportunity to carry. You have to wonder where that's going to lead.
Well, answers to that question depend very much on the side of that debate that one happens to stand
right
on.
Right. We have an email here from Madonna continuing this line. Did you study the tightening or loosening of gun laws? The CDC is legally prevented from counting gun-related deaths. Was your guest able to categorize causes of death, or did he only study deaths as a whole?
That's a great question, and I was only able to get information on total homicides in 56 large cities. I should credit the news organization because the FBI was unable to provide that information. I obtained the information I got from the Washington Post, and it simply was the number of homicides in 56 large cities. So, no, I was not able to look any deeper into those homicides or into possible increases in other gun-related crimes.
Why? Do you know why the Centers for Disease Control doesn't it count gun-related deaths?
Well, I think that's changing. Certainly for quite some time, the Congress had imposed restrictions on the degree to which the Centers for Disease Control could do research and sponsor research on gun-related violence. Over the last now couple of years, those restrictions have loosened. The White House has attempted to lift some of them. And I do understand there is more now firearm-related research going on at the CDC, perhaps not as much as they were doing in the past or as many of us would like to see.
Let's take one more call on this subject, then we'll move on. We'll bring in Ron, who is calling from Ferguson. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to help the professor out. First thing I would say, it was some of all of the above, and there was a report put out by the Chief of Police or Sheriff's Association, and it showed that the vast majority of victims did not graduate from high school, and the perpetrators didn't graduate from high school. So the problems are deeper than just numbers on homicide. You have to go back and try to rebuild families. Because kids, young men that don't grow up with fathers in the home are most likely to end up in prison, which you know, and most likely end up as a perpetrator and a homicide victim. So I think we put too much focus in the wrong area, and we need to be training young people how to have more stable family life so they don't feel despondent. And then also racial discrimination plays a factor in some of it because many of them can't find jobs, and then they leads to crime. And when they get into the crime situation, you know, there's a alpha male syndrome that goes on.
Ron, thank you so much for the call. I know that you're not discounting the things that he brought
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. What Ron calls attention to are the elements that contribute to chronically high levels of homicide. And I wouldn't have much to add to his list. I would simply say, though, that the particular focus of the paper I wrote for the Justice Department was on this very precipitous increase in 1 year. But I don't want to discount those factors that contribute to overall high levels of homicide in communities across the country.
And crime in general.
Exactly right.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for bringing all of this to our attention and for the work you did in this report, Rick. Let's turn now to the racial profiling issue, because that is another concern in this area, needless to say. And I believe you are quoted somewhere along the line as saying this perhaps is also the result of a Ferguson effect.
Really?
Well, maybe I'm wrong on that.
Yeah.
I read a number of things.
I hope that I wasn't quoted as saying that. I haven't. I don't recall publicly tying a Ferguson effect to the racial profiling data that the Attorney General's office puts out. In fact, I would say something along the lines of the opposite, which is I have, with two colleagues, Scott Decker and Jeff Rojek, have been compiling for the state of Missouri and doing some analysis on racial profiling data since the year 2000. So we have 16 years of data now. And what I'm struck by looking at over the long term are not the small year-to-year variations, but the persistence in the degree to which African-American motorists are stopped at higher rates than are white motorists, or for that matter, Hispanic motorists. The persistence in the degree to which Hispanic and African-American motorists who are stopped are searched at higher rates than are whites. And the persistence in the finding that when searched, Indeed, contraband is more likely to be found on white motorists than on black or Hispanic motorists. In spite of year-to-year changes, those major patterns remain worrisomely persistent in these data. Now, I think there are some reasons, some directions we might pursue to get a handle on why on that persistence. And I've called for, along with my colleagues and certainly community organizations as well, some what I would view as relatively modest changes, certainly within the statute, within the confines of the statute that gave rise to the collection of these data, small changes. Right now, the stop rates are based on the percentage of African Americans or whites or Hispanics in the community where the stop is made. But we all know that in the St. Louis area, for example, where you happen to be stopped by the police is not where you necessarily live. What we want to know is, are persons who live in a community and then stop there more likely to be stopped because of their race or ethnic identity than other persons? And to do that, all we need to do is add to the form that the officer fills out, is the motorist a resident of the community where the stop was made? That won't get us all the way to where we want to be, but it'll get us quite a bit of ways. The other issue is that, as some of your listeners may know if you've been up on the Attorney General's website, the data come at the agency level. So we learn lots of things about agencies. I would much prefer, and so would my colleagues, for the data to come at the individual stop level. So you have data on all stops made. I don't think any of us needs to know immediately the identification of officers making the stops, but some characteristics of the officers might be useful. But if we had the evidence at the level of the individual stop, then we could decide whether, well, maybe African Americans and Hispanics are searched at a higher rate than whites because they're arrested at a somewhat higher rate. And every time an arrest is made, a search is conducted incident to the arrest. It would get us a lot further in a serious discussion about why we're seeing these persisting gaps. It's not going to solve the problem. But I think that with what I would regard as modest but quite important changes in the way the data are collected and presented to the public, we can have a – goes back to our previous conversation. Mm-hmm. We can have, I think, a sounder, more evidence-based discussion of what these data mean.
Right. Forgive me for attributing something to you that you did not say. Somehow I got confused on that, but we've clarified that, I hope. I'll give those figures again because I included in the introduction what the profiling numbers were. 69% more likely blacks, more likely to be stopped mm-hmm. than whites. That's down from 75% in 2014. Mm-hmm. A little bit of a drop, but a little bit. It's just a little bit. Would some of the things that you recommend – by the way, my numbers here also indicate that Ferguson blacks are four times more often – are stopped more often than whites. That's a little bit less than the other average. I wonder if that tells us anything about the post-Michael Brown policing in Ferguson.
Four times more likely, did you say, to be stopped?
Four times more often than whites, yeah.
Well, that would be higher. 69% is almost two times more likely.
Right.
So in Ferguson, in fact, African Americans run even a greater chance of being stopped than whites. That's not atypical of some North County residences. Again, though, we have to be a little bit careful. We want to know, was the person who was stopped actually a resident of that locality, because that's how those stop rates are calculated, and they're calculated that way because that's the Attorney General's interpretation of what the law requires. I would argue the interpretation should be broadened a bit.
Okay, let's take a couple of calls. Folks are interested in this subject, of course, and we'll start with Scott calling from Chesterfield. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, according to the Attorney General's report that he does every year, the contraband hit rate for white drivers is higher than for black drivers and Hispanic drivers. And I think what that means is that the white drivers and the black drivers are aware of the fact that the police are profiling blacks and Hispanics. And some police say that they do racially profile and it works. Other police say they don't racially profile. And that statistic, it would seem to me, you know, that both sides of both police that say that are wrong. I don't know, the state legislature did something recently that seemed like a real change, I guess because it's the election year. And you know, but if the police are, if they're doing like a semi-strike, what they're saying is that they're mad and they don't want to be held accountable for who they kill. So, you know, what are you going to do, you know?
Well, you raise a couple of issues there. It is possible that white drivers perceive themselves at less risk for being searched and therefore somewhat more careless. That's what I take from your comment. I think that's possible. I have no idea whether that's the case. But there are other possibilities as well. One other possibility is that black drivers are more likely than white drivers to be wanted on an outstanding arrest warrant. And that's been all over the news in this region recently. So most of those outstanding warrants are based on traffic or ordinance violations. The person didn't show up or didn't pay a fine. A warrant is issued for their arrest. They're stopped for whatever reason. The warrant comes up, and an arrest is made, and a search is conducted incident to the arrest. Now, that search is being conducted without any plain view evidence of contraband in the car, without smelling marijuana odor, for example, or alcohol or anything of the sort. And so it may be, that may be another reason, but only one of several possibilities about why the search rates of African Americans and perhaps also Hispanics are less likely to turn up contraband than those of whites. I should say that that one statistic, the contraband hit rate, the group differences in that one have narrowed somewhat over time. And from the perspective of racial profiling, that's a good thing.
Yeah. You know, I understand what you're saying with regard to contraband and that sort of thing. But when we're talking about profiling per se, we're talking about cops stopping someone because they are black or Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, the officer would not know that until he actually approaches the car.
Correct.
And finds out who's driving.
Correct. And that's what officers do say. Some police agencies, many, it turns out, including the city of St. Louis Police Department, asks officers in the record that they complete after a stop is made, were you aware, basically the question is, of the race of the person you stopped? Many officers don't. I've looked at those data for the city. Many officers don't complete that item on the form. But of those who do, a relatively small fraction say, yes, they were aware of the race. Now, how one interprets that is open to question. I think it's fair to assume, though, that a lot of stops, including those made during the evening hours where the driver's racial identity or any identity is obscured, many stops clearly do occur without prior knowledge by the officer of the race of the individual, not to mention ethnic identity, which
sure,
even under bright light circumstances would be difficult to determine.
Right. Let's take another call. We'll bring in John calling from Hazelwood. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, I often hear about the disparity in the racial makeup of who's stopped and who's not for these traffic offenses. I'm wondering, you know, certainly with the numbers, it sounds like there is some component of racial profiling in there, but I'm wondering if there's any, you know, part of the thing is based on some assumption that, you know, people commit offenses at the same rate. I'm wondering if there's more, you know, if there's any racial component to people actually committing traffic offenses, that, you know, some one group may be committing traffic offenses at a higher rate than another. Is there any validity to that or any knowledge about whether that's the case or not?
I think that's a good point. I don't know the answer to that question. That is information that is available. It's not part of the information, however, that the Attorney General was asked by the legislature to compile, nor is it part of the information that the Attorney General's office has asked me or my colleagues to compile.
That answer your question, John? Okay, I guess John is gone. Well, speaking of the legislature, you indicated that just a little tweaking of what is already on the books could change things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a part of the legislative process, or is that done municipality by municipality?
It certainly can be done by legislative revision, let's call it. And in fact, bills have been introduced into the legislature of varying sorts. At least one of it, which to my knowledge does contain these recommendations that I just made, in addition to some others, and I don't want to make judgments about the others.
But they've gone nowhere.
They one made to committee hearing. I don't think the others, the other one I'm aware of, has. My understanding is they will be reintroduced.
We shall see.
We shall see.
There is already something obviously already on the books. Governor Carnahan signed a racial profiling bill way back when, didn't he?
Well, yeah, it was Governor Carnahan, under Governor Carnahan, that the original racial profiling legislation passed in 2000 was passed. And so, yeah, that I don't I'm not aware of any additional legislation that pertains to traffic stops since then.
Well, you're a busy guy, Rick Rosenfeld. We want to thank you for spending time with us, and I know you have a meeting to attend.
I do.
Talking about things such as this, but thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
Again,
you,
congratulations
Don.
To you on the recent honors.
I appreciate it. Thank
it's
you.
Very well deserved. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.